Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cutting through the noise surrounding a figure who is somehow both this like niche alternative comedy legend and one of the most recognizable voices in mainstream animation.
Right.
We are doing a deep dive into the source material surrounding the life and, well, multifaceted career of Russian-American actor, comedian, and writer Eugene Merman.
That's a perfect way to put it because, you know, when most people hear the name Eugene Merman, they immediately think they hear Gene Belcher.
Yeah, absolutely.
The bombastic, food and fart-obsessed middle kid from Bob's Burgers.
Can't miss him.
But what our sources really light up is that his career wasn't just like one big break. It was this decades-long, almost meticulously engineered path rooted in, well, intellectual rigor and some pretty anti-establishment economic choices.
Exactly. And that's the mission today, right? To really understand that whole career arc. How does someone, you know, bridge that gap?
Yeah.
Going from running these tiny super local comedy shows in Brooklyn to voicing a character everyone knows in a like billion-dollar animated franchise.
Yeah.
We want to synthesize the nuggets of knowledge we have on his really customized education, his unique touring strategy, hitting the rock circuit, and how he translated that particular brand of absurdity into sustained media success.
It's the story of the erudite absurdist, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's the comedian who basically treated comedy like an academic field.
Right.
And then he leveraged that foundation to connect with audiences who, you know, often steer clear of traditional stand-up clubs. That balance, the intellectual foundation meeting this, like, genuine silliness.
Yeah.
That's what we need to unpack.
Okay, let's unpack this. And I think we have to start at the very, very beginning. Tracing his origins from the Soviet Union to that really pivotal kind of defining moment in his early American education.
Right. We begin in Moscow. He was born Evgeny Borisovich Merman, July 24th, 1974. This was within the Russian SFSR Soviet Union.
And that original name, Evgeny Borisovich, it tells such a critical piece of the story, doesn't it?
Mm.
About his heritage. His family background is deeply rooted in that Soviet Jewish experience. His father, Boris Merman, was a civil engineer, identified as a Latvian Jew, and his mother was a Russian Jew. So that heritage and then the move later on, it really forms the bedrock of his perspective, you could say.
And the transition happened really early. The family immigrated to the U.S. when he was just 4 years old.
Wow, four.
Yeah, tiny. Eventually settling in Lexington, Massachusetts. And this is where you get the Anglicization, you know, a really common thing for immigrant families.
Sure, makes sense.
So Evgeny becomes Eugene. And the patronymic Borisovich, it gets sort of shortened, effectively becoming his middle name, Boris. He went through the usual Massachusetts public schools, William Diamond Middle School, and then Lexington High School.
Okay. And it was shortly after that, right, that he made the decision that just fundamentally sets him apart from almost every other major comedian working today, his choice for college.
Indeed. Yeah, he's a graduate of Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts. And this detail, it's so much more than just a footnote on his resume. It's kind of the key, I think, to understanding his specific brand.
Why Hampshire specifically? What's the deal there?
Well, Hampshire College is famous for its really individualized design your own major program.
Oh, okay.
And Merman didn't just pick, you know, English lit or theater or something standard. He literally created his own field of study.
He didn't just study comedy. He earned a specific Bachelor of Arts in comedy. That's just astonishing to me.
It really is.
When you talk about commitment, that is absolute dedication, putting real intellectual weight behind something that's, let's be honest, often dismissed as kind of frivolous.
Think about the depth that requires, though. It wasn't just like a minor concentration. It was a full academic structure he had to build.
Right.
And his degree culminated not in some long, dusty written thesis analyzing humor theory,
right,
but in a practical, physical, one-hour comedy routine. That routine was his official thesis for graduation.
Which just raises this fascinating point. How did that academic pursuit fundamentally shape his comedic persona? You know, we see so many comedians starting from improv or sketch or just grinding it out on the club circuit. Merman started by, like, analyzing the very structure of humor itself.
I think it allowed him to engage in this type of intellectual absurdism. His comedy often plays with logical paradoxes, right?
Yeah.
Satirical takes on self-help culture.
Yeah, like the will to whatevs.
Exactly. And just a willingness to follow a really strange, super specific premise all the way to its illogical end. He sort of learned the rules of narrative and argument, probably just so he could deliberately break them.
Huh. Makes sense.
And that's why he fits so perfectly into niche satire, and also why he can totally hold his own in a panel discussion with Neil deGrasse Tyson. He treats absurdity with this almost like scientific precision.
That's a really profound way to put it. It suggests the erudite part isn't just a label we're sticking on him. It's like a methodology born directly from that college experience.
I think so.
And clearly, he holds that whole experience in high regard. He went back later, right? Gave the commencement address at Lexington High School in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then, kind of bringing it full circle, gave the commencement speech at his alma mater, Hampshire College, in 2012.
Yeah, that circuit is just beautiful. It really validates the whole idea that comedy, if you approach it with rigor, can be a legitimate academic field.
Yeah.
And he's kind of the living proof.
Okay, so now he's got this BA in comedy in hand. What next?
Well, he makes another calculated decision that further defines his path. He doesn't just head straight for the traditional stand-up pipeline, you know, open mics, waiting for spots at the improv.
No.
He totally embraced the alternative scene, often blurring the lines between comedy and, well, rock music.
This transition is so crucial. He essentially carved out this parallel infrastructure for his career. His first big release, the absurd nightclub comedy of Eugene Merman, that came out in 2004. And it was a CD-DVD combo.
Right.
And critically, it was released on Suicide Squeeze Records, a music label known for indie rock acts. That choice alone, right off the bat, it signals exactly who his intended audience was.
Totally.
It's the same folks buying records from, like Modest Mouse or Death Cab for Cutie back then. They aren't looking for traditional Borscht Belt setups and punchlines. They want something weirder, something more countercultural.
And that audience clicked with it instantly. The album got voted one of the best albums of 2004 by places that usually cover music and culture, like the AV Club and Time Out New York.
Wow.
So that basically confirmed that his niche was totally viable, completely outside the established, you know, comedy club ecosystem.
So he basically doubled down on that strategy. 2 years later, En Garde Society comes out.
Who tells the six?
Released by Sub Pop, another major indie music powerhouse, not, you know, Comedy Central Records or something obvious.
Exactly. He's aligning himself with a specific cultural movement. And his output was just relentless in that period. You've got God is a 12-year-old boy with Asperger's in 2009, recorded in Chicago.
Great title.
Isn't it? And then An Evening of Comedy in a Fake Underground Laboratory in 2012. I mean, the titles alone give you a pretty good hint about the kind of surreal, definitely non-traditional stuff he was tackling.
And his most recent sort of big release, the 2015 special, I'm Sorry, You're Welcome, that thing was famously ambitious. Didn't it include like 45 minutes of just screaming?
It did. And like 19 minutes of just sad descriptions of different houses.
That level of commitment to the bit, I really think it stems directly from that academic foundation we talked about, pushing the boundaries of what the format can even hold.
Absolutely. And beyond just the recorded albums, he was becoming a real fixture on the major arts and culture festival circuit. Places like the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, Just for Laughs, Bumbershoot, South by Southwest.
He was establishing himself as an artist, not just, you know, a guy telling jokes.
Precisely. But maybe his biggest impact on the live scene, especially early on, was his role as a producer and curator in New York City. He wasn't just waiting around for a spot on someone else's show. He was building his own stages.
Right. Tell us about Invite Them Up.
Yeah. So he co-produced this weekly stand-up variety show, Invite Them Up, with Bobby Tisdale and Holly Schlesinger. And that show became this incredible platform. It won a Nightlife Award. And if you look at the list of people who came through, Mike Birbiglia, Aziz Ansari, David Cross, Chelsea Peretti.
Wow, heavy hitters.
Seriously. He was directly nurturing that whole indie comedy boom happening in the late 2000s.
And even more specifically, there was the legendary Pretty Good Friends show, right? At Union Hall in Brooklyn. It used to be called Tearing the Veil of Maya.
That's the one. Produced with Julie Smith. That show got voted the best comedy night in NYC by New York Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
This really establishes him as a genuine kingmaker in that specific, very influential Brooklyn scene.
And this curatorial instinct, this preference for a certain vibe, it links directly to how he liked to tour, like David Cross and Patton Oswalt, who were also huge in that alt comedy movement. Mm-hmm. Merman consistently chose to perform in rock clubs and theaters, often bypassing the traditional comedy clubs altogether.
Yeah, he really did. And this choice, performing in venues actually designed for music, that's where the economics of his career get really interesting.
Because he toured as an opener for actual bands, right?
Loads of them. The Shins, Robin Hitchcock, Modest Mouse, Yo El Tengo, Gogol Bordello, Andrew Bird, Cake. The list goes on.
That is highly unconventional for a stand-up comedian.
And it raises that big question for any performer. Why? Why choose the rock club circuit? And our sources actually give us a pretty surprising, tangible answer. It comes down to tour economics.
Okay, get into that.
Merman talked about this openly back in 2012. He basically said that opening for musicians, while yeah, it's uncommon for comics, it offered a totally different pay structure.
Let's drill into that financial nugget because that feels like a massive insight into the live entertainment market itself. He estimated a single music concert could pay up to three times what a standard comedy gig paid. Why? What's the reason for that disparity?
Well, it's probably a mix of things. First, music venues just operate on bigger ticket revenues generally, higher overhead too. But they often have these percentage deals for openers baked into a bigger overall budget.
Okay.
Second, think about it from the headlining band's perspective. Bringing in a cult favorite comedian like Merman, it adds value. It adds variety to their bill. So maybe they justify a higher payment for that.
Right, breaks up the music.
Plus, the audience is probably more likely to be, standing, maybe drinking more, ready to spend money on merch, which helps everyone involved.
Okay, but he did offer an important counterpoint too, right? He said he generally made about two-thirds of what he might earn from doing, say, five separate comedy club gigs over a week.
Exactly.
So it wasn't necessarily about maximizing the total monthly income. It sounds like it was more about maximizing the value of a single night's work.
Precisely. Think about it. Doing five comedy club gigs means flying or driving to five different cities, five separate setups, dealing with five different bookers.
Logistics nightmare.
Totally. By opening for a band, he got one, often larger, payout. He traveled as part of an already established tour infrastructure. And crucially, he got exposed to potentially thousands of people who weren't actively seeking out comedy, but were open to it because they were there for the music.
That's the key trade-off then. Trading maybe maximum quantity of income for a higher quality of income, better exposure, and honestly, probably less logistical stress.
Absolutely. It's a genius move for brand building. It positions him as an artist who happens to be funny, adjacent to indie rock, rather than just another club comic.
And it probably ensures more creative freedom too, right? Rock clubs typically aren't imposing the same restrictions or like audience expectations that traditional comedy clubs sometimes do. You're less likely to have to worry about hitting certain beats or, drink minimums affecting the mood.
Yeah, definitely a different vibe. But Merman wasn't only in the music scene. He was still deeply connected to major comedy tours, running with the best of the alternative scene.
Right, he was on the Legendary Comedians of Comedy tour.
Yeah, alongside Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, Maria Bamford. Huge. He also opened for Flight of the Conchords, which, as we'll see, turned into screen time later.
Ah, okay.
And he toured with Andy Kindler and Marc Maron in a show called Stand Uppity. So he really maintained a foot in both worlds, alternative music and alternative comedy.
And then really cementing his leadership role in that whole scene was the creation of the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival.
Right, which ran for a full decade, 2008 to 2017.
10 years. Maintaining a festival like that, attracting huge talent, basically defining the Brooklyn comedy calendar for a while, that takes intense effort, both administrative and creative.
No kidding. And that whole festival experience became the focus of that 2020 film. It started as a joke. It's a documentary that chronicles the final year. We'll touch on the personal side of that in a bit, but it really showcases how integral the festival was to his whole professional identity.
And we should also note, just to wrap up the stand-up specials part, the recording of his 2015 special, Eugene Merman, Vegan, on his way to the Complain Store.
Ah, yes.
Wrong.
Directed by Bobcat Goldthwait.
Another artist known for embracing the weirder side of things, releasing that on Netflix really solidified his transition, didn't it? From like indie darling to a name recognizable on major platforms.
Definitely. It felt like a big step into wider visibility.
Okay, so moving from those, sometimes sticky-floored rock clubs to the massive corporate structures of Hollywood, let's talk about how his unique sound translated into major screen success. This is really where the voice became the super recognizable commodity.
Yeah, his voice is just distinctive, isn't it? That slightly nasal, super enthusiastic, almost giddy quality, instantly recognizable, and the absolute anchor of his voice acting career, and probably his most famous role overall, is Gene Belcher on Fox's Bob's Burgers.
Since 2011, right? Still going strong.
Still going. And Gene Belcher is just the perfect synthesis of the Merman persona, isn't he?
Totally. He's musical, he's deeply committed to his own absurdity, and he has this kind of joyful, chaotic intellectualism bubbling underneath. He really feels like the son of an erudite absurdist.
Couldn't agree more. And that character is so beloved, so successful, that the role naturally just expanded. He reprised Gene's voice in the 2022 short film My Butt Has a Fever.
Right.
The big feature length, the Bob's Burgers movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he even achieved, like, the ultimate animation crossover dream. Guest voicing Gene Belcher on The Simpsons back in 2018.
That's making it. But his recurring TV roles actually started way before Gene Belcher blew up. For listeners who remember the glory days of early Adult Swim and niche cable comedy, Merman was already a pretty consistent presence.
Oh, absolutely. Before Bob's Burgers even premiered, he was playing Evgeny Merminsky across, what, 27 episodes of Delicated from 2009 to 2012.
Right, Merminsky, another really specific, strange character, often playing on his Russian background for laughs, but always with that specific, slightly off-kilter Merman energy.
Definitely. And you mentioned his touring with Flight of the Conchords earlier.
Yeah.
Well, that relationship paid off nicely on screen, too. He played the character Eugene across 12 episodes of their HBO show between 2007 and 2009.
That's such a perfect example of how his indie collaborations, those relationships built on the road and in those small venues, consistently translated into these bigger mainstream opportunities.
It really is.
Yeah.
We also need to talk about his other big animation mainstay, Archer.
Ah, yes. Cecil Tunt.
Cecil Tunt, the multimillionaire brother of Cheryl Carroll Tunt, appeared in 7 episodes starting back in April 2013.
What's fascinating about Cecil Tunt, especially compared to Gene Belcher, is the contrast, right? Gene is all earnestness and sort of innocent chaos. Cecil Tunt is just pure entitlement, supremely wealthy, and completely unhinged.
Totally different vibe.
But Merman uses that same high, slightly frantic vocal register. He just injects it with this detached, almost chilling, upper-class strangeness. It really shows this range isn't about changing his voice entirely, but finding these new emotional textures within his signature sound.
That's a great point. And if you look at the sheer volume of his really voice work, it reads like a roadmap of the entire alternative animation scene back then. He did various voices on Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Of course he did.
Including characters named Dr. Eugene Merman. And get this, Dr. Gene Belcher.
Hey, wait, pause on that. He played a character named Dr. Gene Belcher on Aqua Teen before Bob's Burgers even launched.
It seems so. Across 5 episodes between 2006 and 2015, it's like this bizarre, deep-cut animation history premonition. Wild.
That is wild. What else from that era?
He also voiced Special Sister in various other roles on Lucy, the Daughter of the Devil, starting in 2007. And he had an even earlier voice role, just credited as Eugene, on Home Movies way back, spanning 1999 to 2004.
Wow, Home Movies. He's been a constant voice, contributing to that strange and wonderful corner of animation for, well, over 2 decades now.
He really has. And the more recent animated credits show the consistency hasn't dropped off at all. He voices the character Burger on that Cartoon Network show Apple and Onion.
Okay.
And even popped up as Dennis Fletcher in an episode of The Boys Presents, Diabolical, in 2022. He is just the definition of a reliable, working voice actor who brings immediate, specific characterization the moment he steps up to the mic.
So shifting gears slightly to live action. While maybe his face isn't as instantly recognizable as his voice.
Right.
His appearances seem deliberately memorable and often pretty bizarre. Early on, there was an appearance as Bernie Foy on Third Watch back in 2002.
Yeah, a more straight role. But the real highlights are definitely the ones that lean right into his absurdity.
Like playing a spokes potato on Food Network.
Exactly. That perfectly embodies the surreal nature of some of his side gigs. It's just perfectly Merman.
And my personal favorite, I think, has to be his appearance as a fertility clown on The Colbert Report in 2011.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the kinds of roles you get when casting directors know you excel at being highly specific, strangely intellectual, but still within the bounds of a really weird joke.
Totally. He also popped up on Broad City as the character Zed in 2016 and had that fun little cameo as Yacht Club Security in the Confess Fletch movie in 2022.
What connects a few of these cameo appearances, especially the more recent ones, is his utility in political satire, particularly with John Oliver. He's been on Last Week Tonight twice now, right?
He has. And the roles he played are just perfect examples of his specific range within that absurdity. In 2016, he was Gary, this highly competent, slightly mischievous hacker.
Yeah, it requires that sense of intellectual mischief.
Exactly. And then just this year, in 2024, he provided the voice of a butternut squash.
From hacker to butternut squash.
The absurdity never compromises, whether the topic is election security or, well, chords.
That adaptability is just key, isn't it? Whether the material is highbrow satire or just pure vocal weirdness, he delivers. And this takes us perfectly into his work beyond the stage and screen his surprisingly deep footprint as a writer and in various audio productions.
Yeah, and this is where we really circle back to that erudite foundation we started with. In 2009, he channeled that sort of academic approach to humor into releasing his satirical self-help book, The Will to What-Ifs.
Right. The whole concept is basically a logical takedown of that hyper-earnest, often kind of silly self-help genre. It feels like a very Merman-esque project.
Totally. Applying that satirical lens to nonfiction just proves, again, that the BA in comedy wasn't just like a fun party trick degree. It was a license to analyze culture and deconstruct established norms, using humor as the main tool.
But maybe the most enduring collaboration he has outside of animation is his regular presence on Star Talk Radio, and then the TV version, too, hosted by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, that's a big one.
On the surface, it seems like such an unlikely pairing, right? A super serious scientist and the surreal comedian.
You wouldn't necessarily put them together.
But if you connect the dots back to his educational background like we've been doing, it actually makes perfect sense. He provides that logical absurdity, that unexpected human element that kind of bridges the really complex scientific concepts for a broader audience. He's clearly intellectually curious himself, which Tyson obviously values.
It's the ultimate example of the erudite absurdist at work, isn't it? Applying his comedic methodology to, like, the entire universe.
Pretty much. He also got into the dedicated podcast world himself, hosting his own show, Hold On with Eugene Merman, for about a year, 2017 to 2018. The sources show he consistently uses audio platforms as this space for, you know, exploration and conversation.
And he's become a really reliable comedic anchor on other popular podcasts, too. He frequently shows up as an expert witness on John Hodgman's Judge John Hodgman podcast.
Oh, yeah, he's great on that.
His quick intellectual wit is just perfectly suited to that format.
Yeah.
You know, resolving these tiny disputes with ridiculously high-stakes absurdity.
He also appeared on Ken Reed's TV Guidance Counselor podcast, and that episode was actually recorded live at the 2015 Eugene Merman Comedy Festival in Boston.
Ah, another example of his different work worlds constantly intersecting.
Exactly. And for those families listening, you might be surprised even children's media has felt his influence. He played Benny the Gerbil on the kids' podcast. This podcast has fleas back in 2017.
Benny the Gerbil. Amazing. He truly has cultivated this incredibly comprehensive, really diversified media profile across pretty much every audio platform available.
So before we bring this whole comprehensive career trajectory to a close, we really should touch on some of the personal life details that kind of frame the context for his work, especially as documented around the final years of his comedy festival.
Right. So on September 7, 2015, he married his longtime partner, Katie Westfall Tharp. And she was actually a professional within the comedy ecosystem herself. She worked as a set decorator on shows like Inside Amy Schumer and Human Giant.
Oh, interesting connection.
Yeah. And they have a son together, born in 2016.
But tragically, she passed away from cancer on January 29th, 2020.
Yeah. A profound loss. And it was really intertwined with his professional life at that time because the documentary about his final comedy festival year, it started as a joke. It captured that incredibly difficult, emotionally intense period. It really shows the, you know, the very real human cost behind the comedy sometimes.
Absolutely. It's important context to remember his work, the festival, his personal life. It was all deeply connected during that time.
Mm-hmm. But the sources also reflect, you know, a continuation of life and commitment. He married comedian Therese Plain in 2023, so still very much within that sphere of creative performance.
Okay. And just for our listener who might need a final quick synthesis of the sheer volume of his output over the years, we should probably rapidly fire off some additional credits that just prove his consistent high level of work.
Sure. Discography-wise, beyond the main albums, there's the earlier Invite Them Up album from 2005, which was so key for that NYC team we talked about,
right,
and the Comedians of Comedy 3 tour CD from 2006, confirming how important he was to that specific traveling show.
And TV appearances just continue throughout his career, right?
Yeah.
Shows like Premium Blend, Cheap Seats, The Benson Interruption, Comedy Exchange back in 2010.
Yeah, the list goes on.
Yeah.
His career is really just characterized by relentless work, whether it's a tiny voice role in an obscure cartoon or headlining his own major festival.
Okay, so to try and summarize this whole trajectory we followed, we started with that highly intellectual, really customized comedy degree thesis back in Western Massachusetts.
Right.
That rigor seems to have given him the confidence to take these big creative and economic risks. It fueled his sort of anti-establishment path through the rock club circuit,
mm-hmm,
which ultimately built this unique brand identity. And that led him eventually to become this beloved and incredibly consistent voice in massive animated franchises like Bob's Burgers and Archer. Looking back at all that, what stands out most profoundly to you in this whole journey?
For me, I think it's that deliberate rejection of the traditional path, choosing audience control and creative freedom over maybe the easier or more obvious route. His willingness to make that economic trade-off we discussed, you know, maybe less total income from fewer gigs, but getting that higher quality of engagement and better exposure in return, that's what protected his specific weird intellectual comedic voice.
That makes sense.
He never really had to flatten out the absurdity to fit the mold of a traditional comedy club booker's expectations.
Mm.
And that, I think, is why his voice translated so cleanly into success with shows that actually value niche creativity.
It's a really inspiring model for any kind of artist, isn't it? He figured out the audience that would genuinely appreciate his specific style, that alternative music crowd, and then he built his entire infrastructure around reaching them, rather than trying to force himself into a system that just wasn't built for him.
Exactly.
Mm.
Which brings us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you and the listener. We've talked in a lot of detail about the unique economics of him touring with bands like Modest Mouse and Yola Tango versus the traditional comedy club grind. So if, as we've kind of seen, the market for live entertainment continues to merge, and maybe more comedians are seeking greater financial and creative autonomy, which other distinctive voice actors, or maybe just comedians with really strong, unique voices, might you see following this exact same road, actually abandoning the standard comedy venue infrastructure for what could be a more lucrative and definitely more creatively fertile scene within rock and music venues?
It raises a really fascinating question about the future of touring comedy, doesn't it? Maybe the most successful comedians of tomorrow won't be the ones headlining the improvs and the funny bones. Maybe they'll be opening for the next generation of indie rock bands.
Something to think about.
Definitely something to mull over until our next deep dive. Thanks for listening.